last time on The Night That Changed Rock.
Back in those days, we'd camp out. We got there at noon on the show day.
And our estimate at 6:30 p.m. were 12,000 people were waiting to get in.
It got to the point where I had just two things on my mind, and that was to keep my feet on the ground and to keep air in my lungs. And then at one point, a door broke.
This is episode 2 of The Night That Changed Rock.
You guys were young. How old were you, 30 years old?
No.
40 years ago?
A bit older than 30. What was he, 34?
Still young.
We were young. We were young, and we were in a world that, like I say, was completely insane. It was insane. Our business was an insane business. The music needed to be louder and louder and louder and louder. We were deafening ourselves every night. And the crowds were getting rowdier and rowdier and rowdier. But it seemed to us, and it seemed to the crowds, that the rowdier it got, the more they enjoyed it. So there wasn't a right way of doing it, you know.
That night, how did you learn? You played. You had no idea that anything had happened.
No idea at all. Until we came off the stage, and we were all in the dressing room. We came off thinking we'd just done a really good show, because crowd reaction was great, and we played well. And then our manager came in, completely ashen, and told us what had happened.
Survivor Mike Simpkin remembers when things went wrong.
You could just feel a surge in the crowd. And it got to the point where I had just two things on my mind, and that was to keep my feet on the ground and to keep air in my lungs. Looking at the front doors, there was cops in front of each door. They were keeping them shut. I'm sure those guys were following orders. They were not opening the doors. Not releasing this massive pressure that was going on outside. And then at some point, apparently somebody took it upon themselves and broke one of the doors that was off to the side. There was glass doors all around the Coliseum, and there was the entranceway in those doors, and somebody broke one of the glass doors on the side. And at that point, the whole crowd surged that way. And that, a lot of people, from what I saw, went down at that point. And I gotta believe when that door broke and all those people kind of pushed towards that side door and a lot of people fell, I gotta believe that's when, you know, that's when our friends and a lot of the 11, that's where they probably never got up again after that. I still haven't completely assimilated what happened that night. My friend is there 1 minute and I never see him again.
Survivor Matt Wergers went through the glass door.
Well, we were, I'd say, 20, maybe less than 30 feet from the gates that were supposed to open. And literally, the pressure of people pushing, if you can imagine, the only way I can describe it is there's a dam and all the water's coming down the river. And it's got to go somewhere, so it just kept compacting, compacting, compacting. That's when literally people were being pushed into the air from the pressure of bodies, because there was nowhere else to go. That's why we chose to get out of the crowd. The only way to get out was go to the right of the turnstiles where we were going to go in to get to the building to try to worm our way out that way. And that's when a big surge came and pushed us once, and then it pushed us another time. And then the third or fourth time, because of the pressure of the bodies pushing us against the glass, we had nowhere else to go, and the glass door actually broke. The glass broke, and we got nothing. We were wearing winter coats, so the only thing that was exposed was our faces, basically. We had gloves on, hats on. So when we went through, I actually went backwards with my girlfriend in my arms this way, because that's how I was cradling a holder, and we got pushed through the window. And I crashed to the concrete floor, and it was glass everywhere, but we just got up and ran just to get out of the the crowd because the funnel was coming. It was more or less a funnel with someone pouring sand that the bodies were trying to get through.
Did you get stepped on at all?
A couple times, yeah. Just people trying to get in. And several other 100 people came through that glass door also.
Thank God that glass door broke.
Oh, I'm very pleased.
Could you imagine what would have happened then?
Oh, there could have been a lot more deaths there. I'm positive of that. If that wouldn't, that was like a dam breaking. If it didn't break the wall with the whole, you know, let some of the water out, or so to speak, the people to subside some of the pressure that was there. It was just mind-boggling, actually. I've never experienced anything like that before in my life.
Former Assistant Police Chief Dale Menkhouse remembers realizing there was a problem.
It was about 7:20, almost 40 minutes late, when the doors finally opened. And unfortunately, they only opened, there were two banks of doors. There were 8 doors on each side, and they only opened 3 to 4 doors on each side. With 12,000 people, when the doors opened, I was behind the crowd, and you could actually see the crowd compressed by at least a third. I mean, it was unbelievable to see that many people just crush into each other. Well, trying to get that many people inside, once they got through the doors, they had to go to ticket takers. Ticket takers can only process about 40 people a minute, and they only had about 8. National standards at the time were 1 ticket taker per 1,000 people. Should have had at least 18. And that crush, and then again, festival seating, first come, first serve, it's bedlam. People running, pushing, jumping over walls, barricades, just to get in. And it was shortly after that door opening that we started getting information there were people down in the crowd. But the crowd was so compressed, we couldn't get in.
And I actually went down on the ground, and Doug, who, thank God, he was really tall, he just kind of, like, grabbed me up.
Survivors Tammy Hart Fales and Steve Upson went to the concert with their friend, Doug.
I'm Tammy Hart Fales, class of 1980 at Finneytown High School.
I'm Steve Upson, class of 1979. But as you're going down, there's other people going down, too. I mean,
right.
And people were yelling, you know, back up, but people,
you can't,
10 people back, you know, first you didn't know what was going on.
Right.
And it was impossible to back up because it was that congested and tight. Yeah. A group was down in front. You couldn't really, you know, your vantage point until you got pushed right onto the pile. Right. And you couldn't really tell what was going on. Or how, you know, you would think you could get up, but there was no space to get up, except for standing on other people, and then,
right.
You know, you'd get knocked back down again. And so it was getting pretty chaotic, pretty scary. Right. At that moment. Doug, I don't know, he was trying to pull some guy out that was on the bottom of the pile, and his head was right by our feet. And he was completely blue colored. He was pretty much gone at that moment.
Yeah.
And we were trying to lift him up, but there was just too many people on top of him that we couldn't pull him out. And at the same time, you know, we're still getting pushed, so we had to put our feet out and step on people to keep from going on the pile too. So it was that crazy. The only thing was to exit. If we would stay there any longer, we would have been, could have
hurt.
Been one of the, you know,
or
would have been 13 or 14 or whatever the number.
So then that's when Doug says, we got to
right, he
get
said,
out
this, yeah, we're out of here.
So we went back and we saw police officers. So Doug went up to the police officer and it's pretty much like, there's people down in there, there's people
barely
dead.
Hurt, you
he's like
do something.
Touching the officer and the officer's like, cuffed him.
Right, eventually Doug kind of pushed him, you got to do something. So, and then he got handcuffed.
Assistant Chief Menkhouse remembers when things went from bad to worse.
So we finally forced our way to the front of the crowd. And I was with 4 officers. We found the first young lady pushed up against the door. She completely blue. We got inside, rushed to the first aid room, and couldn't get in. I pounded on the door, and they finally opened the door, and at that point, I realized this was a major, major issue. They said, there's no room. There were literally bodies all over the floor. There was no more room. Nobody was prepared for what happened. I mean, we had every rescue unit, EMT, paramedic unit in the city was at the Coliseum. I mean, we ended up, 11 people died, 25 were transported to the hospital, and we probably had another 50 to 75 that were treated at the scene.
My name is Guy Nino. I was the chief paramedic for National Medic Service the night of the WHO concert, December 3rd, 1979. Well, the moment John and I arrived, the same police officer that we saw every single event, every single show, fairly, you know, middle-aged black fella, who was always just, you know, he was just always kind of jovial and just, you know, just a good guy and always saved our spot in the right place. And the minute we rolled up, he immediately said, "Drop what you're doing, get on in there, we got some drug overdoses." So we went into action an hour and a half early. We transported that first patient to General, which was our go-to ER. And as soon as we dropped that patient off, she made it. She survived. On the way back, and back in those days, all we had were pagers and two-way radios. We didn't have cell phones. We got a message, code 3, back to the Coliseum. It's now probably 6:30. So we, you know, red lighted all the way back to the Coliseum. And at that point, when we had arrived, somebody had taken our parking space and our ambulance number 2 was parked in our space, but then there were other cars that were blocking the entrance. So we just pulled in, grabbed our gear, and headed for the elevator that took us up to the concourse, which is several floors above the base. We get to the elevator, and the elevator's jammed. It's not going anywhere. So I instructed John, my partner, "You hang for the elevator," because it was just way too much stuff, stretcher, all the stuff. And I grabbed O2 tank, medic kit, everything I could carry, and went up the stairs, 5 floors, whatever it was. So I broke out of the exit door, and it was utter chaos in the hallway. And the first aid room was just kind of around the corner from the elevator bank in the stairway. And I mean, it was chaos. People were flying everywhere. I mean, and just in the most uncoordinated fashion you could ever imagine. I mean, it was just back and forth and all over. I mean, just people were running. So I turned the corner into the first aid room.
So this is inside the concourse. Like, you're not even outside yet.
No.
Had kids busted through at this point? Like.
Yes.
Okay.
The medics room at the time was no bigger than, you know, 10 by 12. I mean, it couldn't have been any bigger than that. She had the nurse that they hired for every event. If she was a day old, she had to be in her 80s. You know, with the white stockings and the little nurse's hat and just kind of the general hospital look of the 60s, you know. But she was good. She, you know, she was essentially our superior, telling us where to go, what to do. So as I literally bust through her door, she's curled up in the corner, nearly in a fetal position. I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bodies. And I mean, the bodies were just coming in at her faster than she could psychologically accept them, very obviously. And for me, I had no one to help me. I had 7 code blues all at once, and I had to decide which patient to work on. And my only criteria was who was the warmest and the pinkest. That was it. I had no idea what was going on. I had no idea what had happened. All I knew was I had to do what I had to do. And I didn't even have my partner. He was still stuck down at the bottom of the elevator. So after doing the initial triage, I picked this one kid, and I'll never forget, red hair, freckle face. He's the kid that keeps coming back to me on occasion. And I initiated one-man CPR. Like I told you, it's a very lonely place to be. You know, and there you are surrounded by all the other victims, a nurse who was incapable of doing anything. One guy had one of the victims had a friend there holding a oxygen mask over one of the victims, just a standard flow oxygen mask that was doing no good. And he was of no help. He was just, you know, he was a lay person. He had no idea what to do. So I initiated CPR and continued until John finally busted into the room, and the sight of his face is still imprinted in my mind like you wouldn't believe. He was a Navy corpsman, had seen action in Vietnam, and so he was like the best partner I could have ever had. I'm on the floor doing CPR to this kid, and he was kind of like a big old dude. You know, John was big guy, and he walked into the room, busted the door open, and he went.
Guy imitates his partner's shocked reaction.
I just looked up at him and I said, John, just pick one and go. You know. And he had a lot of experience on the ships with, you know, severe tragedies in Vietnam, off the coast of Vietnam. And, you know, so he had been through a lot of trauma, whereas I was a fresh young paramedic who had a lot of experience in an emergency room and, you know, working my own company and realizing what was necessary to be the best at what we do. So I continued CPR. He continued CPR on another one. And what seemed like forever, you know, before we had any fire department exposure, anybody else come into that room. When you're doing CPR by yourself, it's a lonely place to be, very, very lonely. Very strenuous, very physically strenuous, very psychologically strenuous, especially when you don't know what's going on.
Did your guy make it?
None of them made it. Nobody survived, other than the first victim that we took to the hospital when we first got there. That was the only one that I knew had survived.
WHO manager Bill Kerbishley remembers finding out there was a problem.
They were maybe like about the second number in, and Larry Maggie came to me and he said that there was a problem up on the plaza level, and he thought it was the result of bad drugs. So I said, what? So he said, yeah, he said, and he said, it's looking really serious. I said, let's go. So I went up to the plaza level with him, and when I got there, it was awful, it was horrific. I mean, there were shoes and clothing everywhere, and the medical teams were working on a lot of the injured in an effort to obviously save them. And I could see for sure that there were a couple that had passed away. Surrounded by all of that, and to see it, and you know, it was difficult, very difficult.
How old were you then? 30 something?
37. Yeah. A mature 37.
But to see, I mean, what you saw, how do you categorize what you saw?
The only way I could sort of illustrate that is, it was almost like I'd walked into an area that had suffered a bomb damage. That's almost what it was like, because it's really strange that people's clothing and people's possessions could be so in disarray and so far from their bodies. It's almost like everything was exploded and went off in tangents, you know, it was just really, but then also to see in some ways it's more difficult to see someone, a medical team, trying to resuscitate and save someone, see someone who's actually passed away, because your emotions and every part of your body is willing them to bring that person back. And I could see that going on around me, you know, at least with 10 or a dozen people. And I didn't know how near or far they were from death. So I don't know how to categorize it or to compare it to anything else really in my life. And in talking, it was crazy as well. I mean, the whole thing that was going on, there was nobody really in my mind that was in direct control. But for me, the first responders, the medical teams, were so engrossed in what they were doing that I don't know who was in control, but I know that a fire marshal came to me and said they were talking about stopping the show, and I said, that's crazy. You cannot, and you're not gonna, I'm not gonna allow you to stop the show. I don't know how I would have stopped them, but I said, if you stop the show, I think you'll have more problems on the arena floor. You could have more people being hurt, for sure. And if they came back through this area, the medical teams are never gonna be able to cope with what they're doing. And if keeping my band on stage saves even one life, to me, that's what it's about. It's really, really important. And then another fire marshal came up to me and he said, he's absolutely right. And he concurred with me. And he said, you know, we've got to be doing what we're doing now. We've got to clear this. So the band carried on stage. I stayed up there for quite a while. And I then went back down. And when the band actually came off at the end of their set, I said to them, look, I got them very quickly and I said, look, go back, only do two songs. We've got a real serious problem. I'll explain afterwards. I think they sensed that it was something really serious, you know, by my tone and everything and demeanor, that there was something serious. So they went back on, played the two songs, came off. I took them into the dressing room and I told them.
Who singer Roger Daltrey remembers getting the news?
It was like, I can't tell you, it was like being just hit with a bat, like coming off stage, and you think you've done a wonderful show, and it was a great show. It was one of the best shows we played on the whole tour. The crowd were incredible. And then we were told what had happened before the show had started. And that was like being whacked with a baseball bat around the head. It was just shock. And I think we did the rest of the tour without really talking to hardly anybody, in total silence. We hardly spoke to each other. We never spoke on stage. We just played our music. We just lost ourselves in our music. It was kind of weird. And it just didn't feel any way to make it right. It was just one of those, that period of being away through that 3 weeks of that tour after the 3rd of December was the longest 3 weeks of my life, I think. And people started to point the finger at us, which was very painful, because we didn't realise what had happened until after the show. And I think one of the people that has never been thanked enough for what he did that night was our manager, Bill Kirbishley, who was at the scene of the accident and was fighting with the police and the fire marshals because they wanted to stop the show, which would have been an absolute disaster, because you would have had the crowd that was already in the hall trying to get out over the rescue workers trying to save people on the ground. So that he possibly averted an even more calamitous event, you know. And he never really has been thanked in the right way. I know what he did that night, but he's never been publicly thanked.
Who guitarist Pete Townsend remembers hearing the news?
I remember the concert was a good concert. I remember feeling good about the show and really good about it. I remember, funnily enough, you know, when that kind of thing happens, you then do think back to the actual event and the concert. I can't remember the set list, but I can remember a couple of moments in the show where I just remember thinking, God, this is such a great show. And it wasn't, you know, Cincinnati wasn't a regular pit stop for the band. So it was a show that we were really anxious to do and anxious to do well. And came off stage and Bill Kirbishley came in and said, I've got some really bad news to tell you, and started to explain it to us. And I went through two phases, you know. One was, of course, tremendous upset and concern, but the other was incredible anger that we had been performing while this was going on. For a long time, and I still do to some extent, and Bill knows this, Bill, our manager, knows this, he decided that we should continue to perform because he was concerned that people would leave the building in a panic if we didn't perform. And so we performed without knowing what was going on outside. So it was very strange to have done that performance, which was very joyful and uplifting, not knowing what was going on outside. And then subsequently, in a sense, to be castigated for doing so. But it wasn't our choice. And I don't know whether Bill made the right decision or not. I don't think he knows.
I'm absolutely positive that I made the right decision. It's difficult. You know, you make a decision like that, you're always going to be second-guessed, or someone's going to say, what if? But, you know, there are no what ifs. What if there were no festival seating? We wouldn't have lost those 11 youngsters. What if it wasn't us and it was another band? Which it quite easily could have been, you know? I still don't have adequate words to explain the feeling and the emotion I had there, you know. To be surrounded by all of that and to see it, and, you know, it was difficult, very difficult.
Next time on The Night That Changed Rock.
At that point, she said, we're going down to the morgue. They have someone that fits our daughter's description.
The Night That Changed Rock podcast is a production of WCPO in Cincinnati. Visit WCPO.com/The Who for video and more. Produced by Tanya O'Rourke and Hillary Lake. Hosted by Tanya O'Rourke. Written and edited by Brian Neese. Who Are You? Performed by The Who, courtesy of Polydor Records Limited, Geffen Records under license from Universal Music Enterprises. Written by Pete Townsend.